Coffee Bar. Programs on WILL are made possible in part by a grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom design, gemstone round tables, and conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada.
Good morning and welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Producing the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls. In the early years of America, perhaps the greatest obstacle to the country's growth was geographic. It was the Appalachian mountain chain, which stands in between the interior of the continent and the coast. Over time, a number of people, among them George Washington, talked about doing something to make a connection, make it easier to cross the mountains and get into the interior. But it was New Yorkers who made that dream a reality by building an artificial waterway from the Hudson River to Lake Erie. This morning, in this hour of Focus 580, we will be talking some about the history of the Erie Canal, how it was built, and its role in the building of America. And our guest for the program is Peter Bernstein. He is an economist by training. He's authored 9 books, including one titled Against the Gods, The Remarkable Story of Risk. He's an economic consultant, publisher of Economics and Portfolio Strategy, which is a letter for institutional investors. He is also the author of a recently published book, which looks at the Erie Canal, which is titled Wedding of the Waters, The Erie Canal and the Making of a Great Nation. It's published by W.W. Norton. It is out now. If you would be interested in looking at the book, I think it's just officially out, maybe even just a couple of days. So hot off the presses, if you're interested in reading the book, it's out there in the bookstores. And of course, questions on this program are welcome. 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222. So here locally in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. At any point here, if you have questions, you're certainly welcome to call. Mr. Bernstein, hello.
Hello. Hello, David.
Well,
Peter, please.
All right, Peter. Well, thank you very much for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it.
Well, it's a privilege to be talking to Urbana. We have good friends there. It's a wonderful place.
When you talk about the Erie Canal, I guess maybe 2 things to start out with just that people need to appreciate about it. And one, in order to appreciate the engineering challenges, one of those would be the length. And I went out and I started looking at the length of some famous canals that people would know about. The Panama Canal, 40 miles. The Suez Canal, 101 miles. The Erie Canal, 363 miles. Is this the longest canal that there is?
There is. The Chinese, it took them 1,000 years to do it, built a canal from Beijing to Shanghai, which I think is 1,000 miles, but it took a very long time and was done quite differently. There was a canal built in France connecting in the south, connecting the Atlantic to the Mediterranean. I don't remember whether that was longer than this canal or not. That was also quite an achievement. Mm.
Well, still significant. We're talking about a very significant distance here that the canal covers. The other thing that's a pretty impressive number is that over the length of the canal, we're talking about a difference in height from sea level, from at the one end, essentially, and if you count from New York at sea level to at the other end at Buffalo, 500 feet above sea level?
Buffalo is 500 feet above sea level, but there are undulations in between that had to be where locks were necessary. So actually, but the whole up and down business of the canal was 700 feet. There's another, if I can interject, there's
sure.
another
oh,
element in this that makes it unique in addition to the length and the date at which it was built. Almost the entire distance was wild, untamed primitive forest, really thick with trees that had been there for thousands, maybe millions of years. And so in addition to having really only shovels and explosive powder, to dig with, this whole forest had to be uprooted. The other canals, and particularly in England, which had an earlier network, and the French Canal and in China, went through civilized areas where land had already been cleared to a major extent, and forests were incidental to it. But this made this job much greater, in addition to the 700 feet up and down that had to be covered.
Yeah. So we're talking about difficult, rough terrain to start, places that were not easy to get to, and no heavy equipment to do it with.
And no civil engineers in the United States at that moment.
That's another one of the interesting things about it, is that the people who did it really had no, it's not something they'd ever done before.
Most of them, most of the people, a few of them had been to Europe and had seen the canals in Europe, particularly in England and Holland. But most of these men were surveyors, and so they knew how to look at land and figure out what the nature of the land was. But one of the kind of feel-good things about this book is this kind of American ingenuity at its very beginning and really impressive. Because it wasn't just the people who served as engineers, but the workmen themselves who were just plain workers, who invented gadgets, particularly for uprooting the trees and uprooting the stumps. Those were developed by just the guys on the job.
Well, let's again just remind people of the geographic problem posed, the obstacle posed by the Appalachians, and how it is that people going back, and as I said, back to George Washington, at least to the 1770s, people were talking about the need to have some easier way to get across them, to get into the interior. If at that time you were going to try to go from the coast to where we are now, you know, Illinois, Indiana, Ohio, how would you have done that, and how long would it have taken you?
This is the aspect of the story that really grabbed me. When I saw George Washington was worried, I figured that
it must be important.
This was important, yeah, because he already before the Revolution in 1775 he was sounding forth about this, and in 1784 he tried to do it with the Potomac River. 1784, right after the Revolution, and it turned into a disaster. The whole mountain chain, all the way from Maine down to Georgia, the only break where there is a waterway is in New York State at a place called Little Falls. There is a break in the mountain chain. And in those days, before the railroads or in our time, the only way you could move stuff, you could move people, they could walk and ride horseback, it was very slow going, the only way you could move stuff was on water. And so to have this waterway was enormously important. The people who built the canal, taming the Mohawk River was an impossible task. Rivers flood and higher in the springtime than in the winter. They freeze, and they're a mess. So the decision was made to make an artificial waterway all the way. But without that break in the mountains, without Little Falls, the story of the country would have been very different, because in all likelihood, the people on the other side of the mountains would have had a separate nation. They would have joined with the French or the British or made a nation of their own. But by having this connection, there was back and forth and there was commerce. And another very interesting aspect to it in the history of the country, it kind of changed the orientation of the United States, as you think of the 13 colonies. It changed the orientation from north-south to east-west. And east-west had a lot to do with what happened later in terms of Civil War and so forth. And then that whole string of cities, of which, in a way, you're a part, but Cleveland and Detroit and Chicago all developed much more rapidly, but explosively after the Erie Canal opened in 1825.
Hmm. And certainly one of the things that you point out, and people would understand reading this story, is that without the Erie Canal, New York State and perhaps also New York City would not be as not have been as important and continue to be as influential as they are.
No question. Boston and Philadelphia were more important places than New York before this happened.
So it seemed, because of geography, that it was natural that the canal be built in New York State. It was, however, also a result of the drive, the ambition, the desire of some people there in New York State to see it happen. And perhaps one of the most important was the man who at one time was the mayor of New York City and then went on to become the governor of the state of New York, DeWitt Clinton, who some people, I guess, would say is an unjustly forgotten individual. Let's talk about this, Mr. Clinton.
Oh, he's a great hero. He's a remarkable, remarkable man. He had also been senator before he was mayor, and later in 1812, he ran against Madison on a peace ticket against the War of 1812 and came very close to winning that election. He was a man who was a real scientist, a worldwide recognized ornithologist, a philosopher. I wish I had time to read some of his writings, because the language and the ability to sense the future are breathtaking. There was tremendous opposition to the canal, partly from people who just figured it was ridiculous, that it was like going to the moon to try to do this and spend all that money, and better things could be done with it. There was political opposition. The presidents in Washington, Jefferson and Madison, tried to block it, refused to give federal money. So it took kind of this single-minded passion of DeWitt Clinton to keep driving and to keep going through all of the opposition, through the War of 1812, until finally in 1817 it got going. He was a man of very broad human interests. As mayor and then as governor, he promoted manumission of slaves, the ability of slaves who came north to become free. He was instrumental in starting free schooling in New York State for the poor. A very, very impressive, a real hero.
Well, you just touched on something that probably is also worth underlining, and that is that the people there in New York went to Washington. They went to the federal government and said, look, we've got this project. We think this is a really good thing that we should do this, and that the president and the Congress said, no, we don't think that's a terribly good idea. It'd be a waste of money. We're just not going to do it. And so ultimately, it was done without any kind of federal funding at all.
That's correct. I mean, Jefferson really told him to go away and come back in 100 years. I give him credit. In 1823, he wrote a letter to DeWitt Clinton in which he admitted his error. And he kind of said, what have you guys in New York got up there? What kind of stuff do you smoke that you were able to pull this off? But it was all financed by New York State. The bonds, the original sales of bonds were bought by little people, by little savers. And it was only after they came forward that richer people came along, people like John Jacob Astor and William Morris, famous American rich people of the time, began to buy the bonds. And then the foreigners came in great amounts after that. It was $7 million, which was then an enormous sum of money. All paid off ahead of time because the tolls were much greater than they originally anticipated. So the funny part is that Washington's project, which was privately financed, and you think, well, private enterprise can always do better, was a financial disaster that went bankrupt, whereas this publicly financed project managed by a committee of politicians was an enormous success technologically. No glitches happened financially, finished on time. It's remarkable when You think of all the other public things that have gone that have been a headache.
Let me introduce again our guest, Peter Bernstein. He's an economist by his training. He is the author of a number of books and a new one which looks at the history of the Erie Canal. It's titled The Wedding of the Waters, The Erie Canal and the Making of a Great Nation. It's published by W.W. Norton. The title of the book refers to an act that was performed by DeWitt Clinton when he, at the completion of the canal in a ceremonial action, took some water. It was water from Lake Erie, and he poured it into the Hudson. Is that
poured it into the Atlantic Ocean.
In the Atlantic Ocean. So it was sort of like the driving of the Golden Spike in a sense, and that's what they called it, the wedding of the waters. Let's talk also about another individual who we talked a little bit about, DeWitt Clinton, and how important he was, who was very important to making this thing happen. This was a man named Jesse Hawley. Tell us about him.
There were a number of people, kind of interesting, offbeat people who had this vision. Hawley was a businessman, and he had, I think he came from around Syracuse, I'm not sure. So I don't remember everything about the book myself at the moment. But and he had been in debtor's prison, but he had been reading reading about canals, and he really pushed some of the people in the Assembly and the Senate to get going and to do it. Probably without there are a couple of people involved, two or three others, but without his kind of push on the people in the Assembly, who then later went to DeWitt Clinton and said, "You have to lead us in this," it might not have happened for a long time, if at all. Very important. But that this was a guy who kind of came out of debtor's prison makes him a little more colorful.
Mm-hmm. Well, are there other people who you think are equally colorful and you enjoyed learning about and writing about?
Oh, Gouverneur Morris. Gouverneur Morris was a real upper-class New Yorker. He was had a great literary talent, and at the Constitutional Convention, he was the one who drafted the Constitution. We the people of the United States, that's his phrase. As early in the dark days of the Revolution, as early as 1777, when he was out in western New York, he predicted that one day ships would be coming from England and sailing on Erie waters. And he was very important in helping to promote the canal because he was so very influential. He was a most colorful man altogether. He lost a leg at an early age and had a peg leg, but that never stopped him from getting around or from any other kind of activity. He was quite a ladies' man. And John Jay, later Chief Justice of New York, once said that Gouverneur had lost the wrong part.
The course of the canal takes it through a number of places that are now, even from people who are maybe not from New York, are recognizable place names. Yeah. Buffalo, certainly, which was made by the canal. That's where it empties out into Lake Erie. But also places like Rochester and Syracuse and Utica and Schenectady and, of course, starting in Albany. When I assume that probably a lot of those other places that the reason that they're big towns now is because they were on the canal?
No question about it. And even the towns that you mentioned are big towns now because of the canal. The growth there was explosive as soon as it opened. One of the nice stories that I think gives a sense of what this thing meant, The canal was finished in 1825, but by 1823 it was open all the way from Albany to Rochester. And when they had the opening celebrations at Rochester in 1823, the first boat that came through from Albany, really from New York City, carried oysters to Rochester. And this seems to me to symbolize kind of the drama of the whole thing, that the technological innovation, the globalization, the national unity, a lot of buzzwords that we use today are kind of encapsulated in that wonderful moment when oysters from the Atlantic Ocean appeared in Rochester. I don't know, it's about 400 miles, I think, from the Atlantic Ocean by the time you go up the Hudson to Albany and then cut across, appeared in Rochester. This was changed the whole nature of the interior of the country.
Well, that's, I think, one of the places in the book it makes the point that if you, before the building of the canal, if you wanted to go from Albany to Buffalo, it would have taken you more than a month. And once the canal was constructed, you could make that same trip in, what, 5 days?
Yes, about 5 days, yeah. The boats, the canal was too shallow for motors. And anyway, steamboats were only just beginning to be developed. So they were all pulled by mules. And they moved at about 4 miles an hour, but they could go day and night. So they could. They changed the mules, the teams of mules, but they could go day and night. And so yeah, they did it in about 5 days. The passenger ships, freight ships took 6 days, because the passenger ships always had the right of way on the canals, on the locks. When you figure that this included going through 83 locks, 27 alone just between Albany and Schenectady. And then this tremendous thing out north of Buffalo, where the escarpment that Niagara Falls falls over, the canal had to climb up that when it was moving west. And it's, you could still do it in 5 days. It was an enormous achievement. Mm.
Now, another one of these statistics I think is, I guess I was a little bit surprised at, and it doesn't take anything away from the engineering feat of building the canal, but it was that the canal is actually not that deep. It's only 4 feet deep.
4 feet deep, yes. Well, that was shallow enough for these kinds of boats, and they could carry very heavy, called Durham boats that could, I've forgotten how many tons of stuff they could carry. But within about 10 or a dozen years after the canal was open, the volume of agricultural produce moving east on the canal began to exceed the volume of manufactured materials moving west. It was really made it possible for us to begin feeding Europe by the 1840s into the 1850s, had a lot to do with changing economic conditions in Europe, that they were able to get the food from the United States.
We talked a moment ago about some of the cities that the canal passes through and how important that was for the development of those cities. How much, and I would have expected that people in those places, some of them at least, would have understood that that would happen. Was there a lot of political jockeying over the course of the canal and where it would go?
No. As far as I could read, I was surprised to say that the answer to the question is no. That they really let the engineers lay out the route. The only place where there was a big fight was at the very end, at Lake Erie, where there was a town of equal size to Buffalo, just north, called Black Rock. And Black Rock was on the Niagara River, a little inland from Lake Erie, whereas Buffalo was right on the lake. And that was a big brouhaha, and it was the one place where the politicians got in the way of the engineers. It finally settled on Buffalo, but that end of the canal was finished later, so much later than Rochester.
Yeah, and that made Buffalo, and I guess that eventually Buffalo it got so big it absorbed Black Rock.
Yeah, Black Rock is hardly mentioned above. It's part of Buffalo now, yes.
Mm-hmm. We're at our midpoint here of this part of Focus 580, and maybe just again I'll mention very quickly, our guest is Peter Bernstein. He is the author of a number of books, including a big bestseller, Looking at Risk, that book titled Against the Gods. He is an economic consultant. He publishes a semi-monthly letter for institutional investors, which is called Economics and Portfolio Strategy, and he is also the author of a newly published book, about the building of the Erie Canal, and the title is Wedding of the Waters. It is published by W.W. Norton and is just out. If you'd like to read the book, it's a good story. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. A little bit earlier in our conversation, you were talking about some of the challenges facing the people who built the canal. The fact that it was the location was remote, so it was hard to get there in the first place. A lot of it was very heavily forested, so before you could do anything else, you had to clear the land, and then also they did not have the kind of big earth-moving equipment that we do. Basically, it was dug with shovels by individuals, by hand. Can you talk a little bit more about, technically, about the building of the canal and just how difficult it was?
I mentioned about the trees, the thickness of the forest. First of all, the trees had to be cut down or torn down, and then after the tree was taken down, there was the stump that had to be removed. Some years in the 1840s, a foreign visitor commented, who had gone out on the canal and seen the farmlands in that area, commented how many of the farmlands had stumps in the middle of the farms. The guys who did the actual work on the canal invented some really complicated gadgets. They're hard to describe on the telephone. I had enough trouble writing about it and trying to get pictures of it, but really complicated gadgets that used mules to pull and turn wheels that first pulled the trees down until they literally snapped. And if you think of a big, thick tree hundreds of years old, what was involved in trying to achieve that. And then another one, again, used with wheels and complicated, basically use of leverage, with the mules pulling ropes to get the stumps out. But they claimed they could do that pretty fast. I mean, it is amazing that this whole thing was built within a period of 7 years, including going up and down the locks. Then in building the locks, the main problem, and in many parts of the canal as well, was to prevent leakages, because the canal was continuously fed by water from streams, neighboring streams around the pathway, and then was full of water, so that either water would leak out or water from outside would leak in. And developing a proper kind of border to line it was complicated. They finally did find something in one local community, and that worked. It was very expensive, and it was the main reason that the canal ran a little bit above the original cost estimates, was because of the extra cost of that mortar. But it's kind of the other one, the most spectacular part of it to me, and I've been there to see that, about 20, 25 miles north of Buffalo, the canal, to give you an idea, the canal went more or less straight west until it got just below Lake Ontario, until it got just north of Buffalo, and then it had to turn left, and go south to Buffalo. But between there and Buffalo is the escarpment that Niagara Falls falls over, now about 20 miles away. So they had to climb, the canal literally had to climb that escarpment. So again, just bare hand shovels and explosive powder, they had to dig through this rock and build locks going up into the rocks. The engineer who did it, they had several of the engineers make designs, really was something. And to make it even more impressive, in the other locks, there's just one lock at each point. And so if a ship was going west and there was another one coming east, the westbound one had to wait. But because this was such an enormous thing at Lockport, at this place where they climbed the escarpment, they built double locks so that traffic could move in two directions at the same time. and so that the construction job was really twice as big as anywhere else. So this took several years to do, but even today, now that there's a modern lock with machinery and to move the gates and all of that, even today, going through the locks at Lockport is a breathtaking experience.
How many people did it take to do this? Because here we're really talking about the main engine, where it was just human beings and human labor.
Again, I'm very bad remembering numbers. My recollection is on the order of 4,000 or 5,000. And one of the things that impressed, there's a lot of folklore about the Irish. And there were groups of Irish who did work on. Most of the workers were people who were already there, immigrants primarily from England or had been born in the United States. But there was a big contingent of immigrant Irish. And they had, I've forgotten the name of the boy who did it, but he would go along during the day and feed them shots of whiskey. And this was if they were doing everything on schedule. And there were songs about, I had a mule, her name was Sal, she was a wonderful gal, or something like that.
Good old pal.
Good old pal, yeah. But the thing that struck me about these people was how literate they were. When there was a commission of politicians who went out to look the situation over in 1810, and when they got to Buffalo, there were a couple thousand people in Buffalo, if that, and there were four newspapers. Today, Buffalo is a city with a respectable population, has one newspaper owned by Warren Buffett. But everybody was literate, and when you read the fulminations, the elaborate speeches that people made, and the insults that they threw at one another in the political battles, it's much more plain English today, because I don't think people are as educated in the language. The common people are nowhere near as educated in the language as they were back then. It's extraordinary.
We had a question from somebody, and I don't know if you have an answer for this. Somebody off the air was interested in if you knew anything about the Wabash Canal, and I'm afraid I don't know it or know where it is, but was wanting to know if there was any connection between that and the Erie. And I think the answer is no, but you could tell me.
Can't answer directly, no, I don't think so. But there were a couple of other canals in the U.S. before the Erie, in particular Middlesex Canal from Boston, which ran up north to the textile manufacturing area, and a couple of smaller ones. But once the Erie Canal was finished, then there was a real tremendous canal boom and eagerness to connect the whole country by waterway. There's one that goes out of, you get to Lake Erie, you're into the Great Lakes, and then you can get down to Chicago, and from Chicago you can get to the Mississippi River. So this was the big drive, was to get all the way to the west. So a lot of these were privately financed. Some of them went bankrupt and so on. Then by the 1830s, the railroads were coming in, and so a lot of those canals either disappeared or were unsuccessful. But the Erie Canal, even after the Civil War, was still carrying more freight than the railroads. It was that important and that inexpensive to travel on.
Yeah, and that is Do I have this right? It's the Chicago Ship Canal. That's the one that'll get you from Lake Michigan to the Mississippi.
Yeah, that's right. I think that's the beginning of it. Yes. Yeah.
But and there were also other canals that were built that do connect with the Erie, along go other various other places in New York State.
Yeah, well, one that was built at the same time. This was sort of a political sop, but it was considered part of the Erie Canal system was the Champlain Canal, which came down from Lake Champlain and still does, came down from Lake Champlain and joined the Erie just around Troy, just very close to Albany. That's still functioning. And interesting, this summer, up at Lake Champlain, they've reconstructed what's called a sailing canal boat, and this this boat is going to sail down Lake Champlain and then come into the Champlain Canal. The sails are removed and come down to Albany and then down the Hudson to replicate what went on in those days. But that was very important in helping to feed the traffic from New England, which was certainly the most thickly populated area of the country at that time. So it was very important. Washington's Canal, the Potomac Canal, became the C&O. Then what's called the main line in Pennsylvania today, near Philadelphia, which we think of as a railroad and where the Tony people in Philadelphia live, that was originally a canal.
We have a couple of callers here to bring into the conversation. Let us do that. And the first is in Bloomington, Indiana, and that's line number 4. Hello.
Hello. I just wanted to join your guest in commenting on how well-educated our American ancestors were. I think it was John Quincy Adams who said that an American who could not read and write was as rare as a comet. And he said that almost all of these Americans could read and write neatly. And when Alexis de Tocqueville came to America, he was also very impressed by the fact that the farmers would take philosophical books into the field with them. I mean, they were very well educated, and I just wanted to join your amazement at how well educated our ancestors were.
Thank you for the comment. That de Tocqueville in general was an important source for me. He has in 1830, 5 years after the canal was open, was when he was here, and he describes what the forest was like just 4 or 5 miles away from the canal at one point, and I quote that at some length because it's so vivid.
All right, let's go to another caller. Thank you, and we'll go to someone here in Urbana, line 1. Hello.
I don't know how neat their handwriting was. Some of the records I've looked at from the mid-1800s are really hard to read, but that's not why I was calling. I've discovered some relatives who went out to Ohio in the late 1830s, I think it was, didn't like it, went back to the coast of New Jersey, stayed there for a while longer, and then came back. And the first time they went out by wagon, and the second time they went up through across from the Erie Canal to the Great Lakes and then down in Ohio, which seemed like kind of a roundabout way. But when I read about what the roads were like, ran across somebody else who people earned apparently money in Indiana on the roads where people were migrating west, doing I think what was called chuck holing. They would charge wagon immigrants money to get them out of chuck holes in the road, and then they'd go half a mile, and then they'd be stuck in another chuck hole because the roads were so bad. It must have been really, really discouraging to travel by wagon. But I'm wondering what it was like to travel, if you have any idea, to travel on the Erie Canal. Did you moving all of your goods? Did you load it up on a wagon and load the wagon onto the...
You could not put... what we call packet boats, which were passengers only. And then there were various kinds of boats that carried freight and sometimes a few passengers. So I suppose those could put the wagons on. It's an interesting question. It hadn't occurred to me. What did the people who want to go further west do after they got to Lake Erie?
If you're thinking about moving everything, they're moving... They didn't have moving vans, so they weren't just travelers. They were picking up their livestock, and I don't know if they had livestock, but
they
were all the goods.
They would take livestock maybe on the freight boats. But from all the pictures that I've seen, people did have great big bags, but the boats were very crowded. The sleeping quarters, since you were there day and night in most instances, if you're going the whole route, the berths were three tiers high. Men separated from ladies, but very crowded, very smelly, very noisy. So there wasn't room for people to take much along with them.
Does your book have engravings or photographs?
Excuse me?
Does your book have illustrations?
The book does have illustrations, and they're really nice. They're really colorful, and I think you get a real sense of what it was like. We also have wonderful contemporary travelers, descriptions, including some foreigners who were hysterically funny about a lot of it. But I have just in front of me, I brought some notes. Fanny Trollope, the mother of Anthony Trollope, was over here and with him as a little boy. She refers to a town called Avon, which is near Rochester, and she calls it a draggling, ugly little place. This Avon flows sweetly with nothing but whiskey and tobacco juice. So you get stories of the kind of people with the horrors, and then people who were amazed at how wonderful it was. But you've got both kinds. Here's a woman who described breakfast on one of the packet boats: pike or bass, steak, bacon, sausage and ham, scrambled eggs, baked pretties, whatever that is, boiled cabbage and squash, broad bread, and pancakes, and dinner will be heartier. This is on this little narrow 20-odd foot wide boat with, I've forgotten how many passengers on it.
Amazing. Thanks a bunch.
All right. Thanks for the call. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Our guest is Peter Bernstein, and he's the author of the book Wedding of the Waters. It's a new book. It's just out now. It's about the building of the Erie Canal. Something else that I think is an interesting just little factoid that tells you something about the significance of the canal is what it meant to commerce in this sense that before the canal was built, if you were going to ship a ton of goods from Buffalo to New York City, it cost $100, $100 a ton. After the canal was built, you could ship that same ton for $10.
I tell you, one of the more interesting people in this story is Robert Fulton, who in 1804 figured out exactly what the, if there were such, this canal were to be built, and he was, it's 20 years before it was finished, what the reduction in cost would be, and he was almost right on the button. He was a big canal enthusiast in any case, but it's very important in thinking about the canal. It was wonderful, as my friend who just called up commented, that for the people going west, it was a great way to travel. But the real driving force was business. And this is what Washington commented about in 1775, that unless we were doing commerce back and forth, that the ties wouldn't really be strong. Another French visitor who came in 1830, a man named Chevalier, and closer to my heart than de Tocqueville because he was an economist, and he said that all an American sees in merchandise, all that an American sees is merchandise in his eyes. To him, a waterfall is simply water power for his machinery. The business sense, the commercial sense was very, very strong, and it flowered immediately.
Well, you talked a little bit earlier about one of the things that the canal did was it changed, in a sense, it changed the orientation of the country from one that was oriented more along north and south lines to one that was oriented along the east-west line. So that it certainly had an effect on the way the country developed and how Americans thought about themselves and the country and so forth. And also, and maybe you could talk a little bit more about this, and it'd be appropriate since you are an economist, is what this meant to the economy of the United States.
This really kind of gets the Industrial Revolution going. As a result, of the Erie Canal, one of the most interesting things I happened on in doing my research was the number of patents that we had patent law already that early in our history. The number of patents filed in New York State after the canal was opened was very rapid. The number of factories built along that route was very rapid. And then, as I don't have to tell you from where you're located, as this movement opened up from New York City right directly by water, directly into the Great Lakes, you got Detroit, Cleveland, the Chicago line. And while agriculture was enormously important moving east, this began, and the coal supplies of Pennsylvania became more easily available, the Industrial Revolution came along. And so that cotton, which had been the major crop, and cotton and tobacco, really the big sources of wealth in the early days of the country, and where most of the wealthy people came from, that part of the country, it began to shift to an east-west direction and a more industrial direction. And so that, as I said, this led ultimately to where we ended up in the Civil War. One of the things that struck me, you mentioned DeWitt Clinton, is that he himself, in talking about how important the canal was going to be, predicted this change in focus. And he said, well, someday there may be controversies between North and South over economic arrangements, that this, we're going to have this tremendous development in East-West economic commerce and trade.
Let's talk with someone else. We have a caller here in a nearby community, Savoy, line number two. Hello.
Hello, yes. I maybe it's already been mentioned that there's a wonderful place to review a lot of what the speaker has been talking about. This summer we went to Seneca Falls, New York, and for the Waterworks Museum, and we also, of course, saw the Women's Museum there, too. And I highly recommend that for a trip.
Yeah, that's a very, very interesting point. It's almost in the middle. And the canal was, they were very clever when they built it. They built it in three sections, a middle section, an eastern section, and a western section. And the middle section was the easiest because the country was flattest in there. And Seneca Falls was kind of the western end of the eastern section. It was a very important point there.
And I like the way that they had examples of the stump puller and so on.
Oh, they do?
And very good history of the whole episode, so that anyone that's interested in more might want to consider a trip to Seneca Falls.
It's so beautiful there. That's near the Finger Lakes and everything.
Mm-hmm.
It's wonderful.
Okay, thank you.
All right. You. Well, again, thanks for the call. If somebody wants to call here real quick and get in question, 333-9455. We do also have that toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. The construction, as I understand it, started in Rome, New York.
That's correct.
And then proceeded east. It seems a little odd. I guess one would have thought that, well, maybe you just start at one end or the other and work your way the opposite direction. Why was it that they started with that section first?
It really started in Rome and then went both directions. If you go to Rome, they have a wonderful facility there where you can ride on a canal boat just like the old ones. And it's a marvelous sensation, the quiet and peacefulness of it. Because it was very flat there. At the other end, between Albany and Schenectady, the rise is so steep that there were 27 locks. And at the other end, as I mentioned to you, the Niagara Falls escarpment. So, around Rochester, the landscape is very uneven. So they decided to do the easiest part first, both because that would keep the political opposition down, and also that they would learn from experience and would find it easier going when they moved toward the west. Hmm. So the middle section was done first, was completed, I can't remember now, but I think in about 3 years, very, very fast. It was 100-odd miles. And then they began working their way east and west, where there were much more complicated problems to deal with in terms of very, very steep drops. And much rockier kinds of land.
Altogether, how long did it take to build?
They started in September 1817. 4th of July. Everything started on the 4th of July, 1817. It was finished in the autumn of 1825. Hmm. 8 years. So $7 million, including the Champlain Canal. The equivalent of about $70 billion in today's economy. What's interesting, though, another comment on today's world, it costs about $1 million a year to build. It would have been built sooner if the War of 1812 hadn't come along. The War of 1812 cost $10 million a year, $30 million altogether. So when war comes along, the money gets spent without anybody making a big fuss about it. But when something like a huge public project like this comes along, it took 8 years before, or many years, before they even agreed to do it.
Well, I'll tell you, I have a couple of callers here, and I have to apologize to them because we don't have the time. We've simply come to the end. It is a fascinating story, and if you would like to read it, well, you head out to the bookstore and look for the book. Again, the title is Wedding of the Waters. That's wedding as in marriage, wedding. The Erie Canal and the Making of a Great Nation. It's published by W.W. Norton by our guest, Peter Bernstein. And Mr. Bernstein, thank you very much for talking
with
us.
Thank you, David, and all those wonderful questions. Great.
Our program, Focus 580, is made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates this year, celebrating their 23rd anniversary. Bodywork Associates has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. The broadcast today is also made possible with support from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium at 203 North Vine Street in Urbana. The Corkscrew carries a full line of wines, beers, and spirits for everyone from the serious collector to the first-time buyer. Wine tastings are held every Friday from 6 to 8 p.m. and Saturday from 2 to 6 p.m. Information is available at 337-7704 or on the web at thecorkscrew.com. Just a reminder before we go that tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour of the show, we'll be talking about Indonesia and current politics there. And in our earlier hour today, we were talking about all of the damage caused by the tsunami, and certainly that plays into the story of what's happening today in Indonesia. We'll be talking with Lauren Leiter, who's professor of government at Cornell. Then in the second hour, we'll explore another little bit of American history as we talk with Paula Gunn Allen, who's professor emerita of English and American Indian Studies at UCLA, who has authored a biography of Pocahontas. That'll be tomorrow. We're here weekday mornings 10 to noon, 10 different topics every week. And, of course, we always welcome your questions and comments. Right now, we want you to stay tuned because coming up next is the Afternoon Magazine with Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, a look at the role of the dog in American history. We'll rebroadcast an interview with Mark Durr, the author of A Dog's History of America. That follows the 1 o'clock news. Later, life aboard a deep-sea fishing boat in winter in the North Atlantic. Redmond O'Hanlon will be my guest. His latest book is Trawler. I'll talk with him following the closing market report. Let's take a look now at what is happening on the Chicago Board of Trade and Mercantile Exchange. March wheat, 296 and three quarters, down one quarter. May, 304, down one half. March corn, 199 and three quarters, up three quarters. May, 207 and a half, up three quarters. July, 214 and three quarters, up one. December corn, 231 and a half, that up one and a quarter. March beans, 523 and three quarters, down two and a quarter. May, 522 and a half, down one and a half. November, 538 and a half, down two and a quarter. March meal, 157.80, that down 10. March